You are listening to Setting History Straight with Linda Watson.
Welcome to our show, and we have a real treat. We have Stephen Spikerman with us. Many of you have actually wrote me and asked me if I could get Stephen back on. So we've got him back on today. Stephen, how are you?
I'm very well. Never better.
We're so excited to have you back on. Your teachings are always so informative and good. So, Stephen, what are you going to cover with us today?
Well, I'm going to talk about American history, which is always very, for some peculiar reason, is very close to my heart. And it's been a real interest of me. I'm raising a question. And the question is, are the American War of Independence and the Civil War prophesied in the Bible?
Yes, that's a wonderful subject. I'm dying to hear what you have to cover on that. So I'm just going to turn this over to you, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Well, obviously, I wouldn't be raising the question if there wasn't a positive answer. Right. So it's in the book of Isaiah. There is an extraordinary prophecy there about the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. On the face of it, the meaning is totally obscure, and it seems completely impossible to explain. You know, if you don't know anything about American history, if you're also not aware that of the biblical identity of the American nation and the British nation, they are representing the two sons of Joseph. So if you don't have any of that understanding, well, then you're at a loss. You won't understand what Isaiah is talking about. The reality, it's only those who understand the ancestry of the modern-day birthright sons of Joseph who can possibly understand the meaning of this prophecy. It's only once you become aware of the true origins of America and Great Britain that you have the key to unlock the meaning of this remarkable prophecy. Yet, even if you were armed with this key, it would still be pretty difficult to understand exactly what this prophecy means, as you also need to have a fair knowledge about American history to get the whole picture. Nevertheless, by this prophecy, we can further discern the modern-day identity of the two sons of Joseph. So let us now carefully examine the chilling, and indeed it is a chilling prophecy spoken by the prophet Isaiah. I'm going to turn to Isaiah chapter 9, and I'm going to read to you verse 19 through to verse 21. And it says, "Through the wrath of the Lord of hosts, the land is burnt up, and the people shall be as fuel for the fire. No man shall spare his brother. And he shall snatch on the right hand and be hungry, and he shall devour on the left hand and not be satisfied. Every man," and this is the actual key scripture, "every man shall eat the flesh of his own arm. Manasseh shall devour Ephraim, and Ephraim Manasseh. Together they shall be against Judah." Well, we'll leave "together they shall be against Judah" away for the moment. The key passages that Manasseh is going to devour Ephraim, and Ephraim is going to devour Manasseh. That the two sons of Joseph are going to be in a situation of war. They're going to go to war against each other, right? So that is what Isaiah is saying. Now, we have no history of it having happened other than in the history of America and Great Britain. And when we're talking about the colonial war of independence, the American War of Independence, the Revolutionary War of Independence, then we get some idea when the two nations were at each other's throats.
That's an interesting verse.
Yeah. So the British Exchequer, after Britain's victory over the French, they were fighting the Seven Years' War from 1756 to 1763, and that was virtually a world war that Britain was fighting. Had become Britain Exchequer, had become depleted, and they were in sore need of funds. And war tends to bankrupt the state. And they were in that sort of scenario. So the Parliament in Westminster was looking for ways to raise extra revenue, needed to replenish its coffers. Now, some in the British government reasoned that as much of the war effort had been for the benefit of her American colonists, the English colonies, it would only be fair to have some of those rich colonials bear some of the burden of taxation. Thus, the decision was made to levy a special stamp tax on the Americas. and the Stamp Act of 1765 was the first direct tax imposed by the British Parliament, or the English Parliament, on their American brothers. In the reality, the Americans were only being asked to pay a share of their own defense, because, you know, the English Navy had been defending the English colonies in North America. So, but as it was, the new tax, even though it effectively doubled the local taxes of the American colonists, it still only came to a flat rate of 2 shillings per person, which is about 1/10 of what the English were paying to the British exchequer, you know?
Right.
And
right.
So they weren't being asked for very much. It was a minor amount. But nevertheless, the people, the English colonists in America, in the 13 colonies, didn't see it that way. They felt strongly that the British Parliament had no right to pass laws on Englishmen in the Americas who did not have elected representation in the government at Westminster, London.
Right.
Very soon the cry went up, no taxation without representation. And this then became the popular war cry throughout the 13 colonies. All right. So there you have the of the Revolutionary War of Independence. Now, what we find so interesting is that what happened then was actually a repeat of what happened in ancient Israel, you know, several thousand years earlier. And we see history repeating itself in the most remarkable way. As in ancient times, the division of Israel into two separate nations was over exactly the same issue. It's interesting to note that when the 10 tribes of Israel split away from Judah, the cause for the division was the onerous taxation plans of King Rehoboam, who was the son of Solomon. And it was the king's introduction of higher taxation that drove the 10 tribes of Israel to rebel against their monarch. And this same Rehoboam was a very stubborn king who simply would not budge or compromise, very much like George III of England, who also wouldn't budge or compromise. And thus, in ancient Israel, the same cry had gone up, no taxation without representation. Although they didn't phrase it quite the same way, what they said, in fact, and I will quote it from the first book of Kings, where their exact words are recorded in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 16. And I'll read that to you. Now, when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, "What share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now seat your own house, O David." In other words, you get stuffed. We're off. We don't want any more to do with you because we're not going to pay these taxes. You see what I mean? So
yes,
very much
yes.
the same scenario. And the fact was that the tribes, the 10 tribes, also did not have any representation. Everything was decided by the royal court and the king's advisors, who were all from the house of Judah. Understand? And so the 10 tribes had no say in the taxation. The king decided, and that was it. It was very much the same situation, really, with the 13 colonies, you know, the 13 English colonies. They also had no say in it. The king decided, they were told about these taxes, and all they had to do was pay them. But they weren't going to do it, because no say in the decision. So with wisdom and willingness, obviously, and a spirit of compromise, the conflict could quite easily have been avoided. In both cases, in ancient Israel, it could have been avoided if there had been some reason, you know, on the part of the king particularly.
Right.
And the same in the Americas, you know, if King George III had been reasonable and understandable about the no representation situation, you know, if he had said, okay, we'll give you representation. If he'd explained, look, this is to protect you. You know, we've actually been defending you for 7 years, been fighting all your enemies for 7 years. It cost us a fortune. It virtually bankrupted us. We really need this contribution from you. And yes, we'll give you representation. I'm sure the whole thing would have been sorted out. But you see, that didn't happen. There was absolute intransigence on both sides, and they were not willing to compromise. So the result is war, right? No jaw, so you get war. So the colonists looked upon Britain as their mother country, and they talked of her as home, And now, for want of a little give and take on both sides, in a spirit of compromise, both Mother England and her own colonial children were fighting each other. Thus, just as Isaiah had prophesied in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 21, Manasseh was devouring Ephraim. The founding fathers of America clearly recognized the biblical connection between the Israelite experience of coming out from Egyptian bondage and their own battle against the colonial bondage under the tyranny of an English king. For example, Thomas Jefferson originally proposed that the reverse side of the American seal portray the liberated children of Israel in the wilderness being led by a divine pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire by night. And Jefferson's own motto engraved on his personal seal was borrowed from Oliver Cromwell, the famous words from Oliver Cromwell of justification, and the words are, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." Now, they are recorded as Jefferson's words, and it is Jefferson's motto, but he borrowed it from Oliver Cromwell. Now, Manasseh devours Ephraim, the War of Independence. When in 1775 the first shots were fired in anger, the two brothers, Manasseh and Ephraim, were fighting and devouring each other just as the prophet Isaiah had prophesied. Fighting began at Lexington and also, rather ironically, at a place called Concord. There was no Concord there, I can tell you. Just a smell of gunpowder. Now, William Pitt, the great wartime Prime Minister of Britain at the time, during the Seven Years' War, now old and somewhat ill, warned the nation at the time that England's enemies would take advantage of this unnecessary family squabble. And when he talked about enemies, he was primarily thinking of the French. William Pitt by then made a lord, and he was called Lord Chatham at the time, and he worked tirelessly to stop the conflict. He said, and I record, "You cannot conquer America. They are our own blood. If I were an American, as I am an Englishman, I would never lay down my arms. Never, never, never." The plain fact is that there are no two other nations on the earth that fit this prophecy of Isaiah so absolutely. Every man shall eat the flesh of his own arm. Manasseh shall devour Ephraim, and Ephraim Manasseh. Isaiah 9, verse 20 to 21. And this prophecy gives a very vivid picture of what occurred during the American War of Independence, as when brother fought against brother, they were hurting themselves. They were indeed, metaphorically speaking, eating the flesh of their own arms. Now, born out of the womb of Great Britain, William Pitt's warning came true as France, England's perennial enemy, saw her chance to get her revenge for her crushing defeats during the Seven Years' War. She supplied most of the weapons and gunpowder for the American revolutionaries. And come 1777, French volunteers were arriving in Virginia to assist in the fight against England. One year later, the French became formally allied to the Americans. And soon afterwards, the Spanish and Dutch too declared war on Britain. In no time at all, Great Britain was pressed on all sides as she was fighting an imperial war virtually of worldwide proportions, almost against most of Europe and all her colonial empire, as well as her own 13 colonies in America. So Parliament demanded an end to the war, and Lord North, the British Prime Minister, resigned. There's a big, big crisis going on. And then finally in September 1783, the Treaty of Paris was signed at Versailles, with Britain recognizing the independence of her 13 rebellious colonies. Now, she'd lost them, and apart from Canada, she lost all her hard-won possessions in North America. Yet out of this conflict, a new nation was born.
And, you know, there was really no logical reason for America to separate from Britain, right? Because it was not that high of a tax.
No, the reason why America had to separate is because of prophecy expressed by Jacob in Genesis 48 and also Genesis 49. There had to be a separation between Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim had the primary birthright, and she got there first, if you like. She received her glory and her abundance and her incredible blessings before the United States. The United States was actually born out of her and launched by her, but there was a time when the United States should take over. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I got you.
It had to happen. It's meant to happen. Now, if you go back a little further in the history, we have the Puritans in the 1500s, you know, we can discern there was strife between Ephraim and Manasseh. In those days, in Old England, there was a civil war between the people of the Yellow Ribbon. In the English Civil War, were the Puritan cavalry officers and all the soldiers. They wore yellow ribbons and sashes, and they did so to identify and distinguish themselves from the royalist forces on the battlefield, who wore red, okay? Thus, the yellow ribbon became an established part of Puritan heraldry. And this same yellow ribbon has ever since played an important role in American history, especially in times of war. And the Puritans would fight under a great banner, a huge banner, stating, "In God we trust." Until recently, we've seen, I think it's still on the U.S. dollar bill, isn't it? "In God we trust."
Yes, or had it is. Yes, they haven't taken it off yet.
They haven't taken it off yet. I expect they will soon. Anyway, the Puritans were great change agents. In fact, the ultimate change agents of the Reformation in the early 1600s. They were able to take control of the English Parliament, and the situation culminated in the Puritan War against King Charles I, otherwise known as the English Civil War. And after the execution of the king for treason against Parliament and the people, Oliver Cromwell, as the Lord Protector, became the effective ruler of the nation. The question is, was this strife between the Puritans and the Royalists another example of Manasseh devouring Ephraim and Ephraim devouring Manasseh? Is it perhaps conceivable that even some 130 years prior to the Revolutionary American War of Independence, embryonic America was struggling to escape from the womb of Great Britain? It's an interesting thought.
Yes, that is an interesting thought. So this was in their heart from the very beginning, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it's the Puritans who founded America.
Yes. So
America and Britain have a special relationship. It cannot be denied that the United States of America has a special relationship with Britain. And she's come out of the womb of Great Britain. And just like any birth, it's been accompanied by much pain. The pain was the Revolutionary War.
That's very interesting now. I didn't think of it as a birth like that. That's interesting.
The relationship between a mother and a child is always a special one. As the saying goes, blood is thicker than water. Yet isn't it interesting to notice that ever since America gained its independence, the world in political circles has never stopped talking about what they perceive as a special relationship between America and Great Britain and vice versa.
Right.
So that's strange because they fought each other to the death in the Revolutionary War of Independence. And then in some ways, in the Civil War, the same two sides were at each other's throat. And I will get to that a little later, because the Civil War was, in a way, a continuation of the Revolutionary War. But I'll explain that a little later. Now, so it's unusual that after that, they forged a special relationship, which is still effective until today. Now, of course, in Joseph, the son of Jacob, they share the same patriarchal ancestral father. And in Asenar, the Egyptian wife of Joseph, they share the same ancestral mother. Of course, with that common pedigree, background, and experience, it would be very strange indeed if there were not a special relationship. I know Winston Churchill described this relationship in his usual humorous fashion. He said, America and Great Britain are two people divided by a common language. Yeah, we say potato, you say potato. We say tomato, you say tomato.
Can I tell you, when I went to England, you're going to love this story. So I was standing in line to get a postcard, and somebody walked up to me and they said, "Pardon me, but are you queuing?" And I didn't know what queuing meant. And I said, "No, I don't think so." And they stamped in front of me. So I understood then that queuing means standing in a line.
Yes. Yeah. They're very orderly people, the British. They like to queue and stand in line, and they don't think much of it if you jump the queue, you know?
They're very structured. Very structured.
Yeah. Yeah. So, just as the patriarch Jacob had declared, the time had come when the two brothers should walk separate paths. And the prophecy had to be fulfilled, and it was always inevitable that it would be fulfilled within God's perfect timing. For this reason, it was necessary for Great Britain to lose the American War of Independence, as his elder brother had to go his own way in the world to become a great nation, just as was prophesied by the patriarch Jacob. If Britain had not lost that war in the resounding way she did, the prophecy would not have been fulfilled, and the credibility of the great God of Israel would have been put into question. It was God's purpose that Britain should lose that war. Ephraim was meant to lose it, as it was to be the instrument in bringing the blessing of the birthright to his E.G. America. Huh?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So now we move on to George Washington now, a man of destiny, if ever there was one. George Washington sits astride American history almost as a patriarchal figure, and he's looked upon as the father of the nation, quite rightly. And physically, he cut an impressive figure, as at 6 foot and 2 inches tall, he towered above most of his contemporaries. He had a straight military bearing and was a man with natural authority. He was a superb horseman who loved country pursuits such as hunting and shooting. He was the natural choice of the American colonies as their commander-in-chief, as he was a fearless soldier, but whenever faced with danger, always kept a cool head.
So, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, Stephen, because, you know, that's kind of like Saul, because remember, Saul was taller than everybody else.
Yeah.
He stood above everybody else. And 6'2" was tall at that time.
It was very tall at that time. It's not so tall now because we eat more, I think. I'm not sure we eat better, but we eat more. Now, inevitably, after further 3 years of bloody war, on October 17 in 1781, the British forces under General Cornwallis surrendered at the famous siege of Yorktown. That the final battle should take place at a town called Yorktown is highly significant in that the original meaning of York is castle or stronghold of the Hebrews. It is at this castle of the Hebrews, Great Britain is forced to surrender his sword to his Hebrew brother, USA. To add to the humiliation, the English troops were forced to march out of Yorktown with their colors, the red ensign, encased, and they went out with great dignity in true British grit style, and the British military band played "The World Turned Upside Down," a most appropriate tune, as it described exactly how the British felt. For them, the world truly had been turned upside down, as their outstanding record for many centuries was to win wars rather than lose them.
Yeah, they pretty much won all their wars.
Everything. They won everything. They fought 30 wars against France, and they won them all.
Yeah. Well, that was a real blow to them, wasn't it?
This was a huge blow. Yeah, a huge blow. And this is why it's so remarkable how quickly they recovered and then won themselves another empire. You know what I mean? They lost an empire, and they went and got another one.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So the formal peace treaty was signed in Paris on September the 3rd, 1783, accompanied by much gloating in France over England's misfortune at having lost the war. The French always like to gloat at our defeats. And they are no lovers of America, neither are they lovers of Great Britain. So they had come to the aid of patriot continental cause, not because of any regard for the Americans, but simply to thwart and spite the English from gaining their place of destiny as the prime inheritor of the birthright. Now, you and I know why this is so, and the reason is that the French are descended from Reuben, the eldest son of Jacob, and the eldest son always, naturally, would be entitled to receiving the birthright and become the head of the family. But because Reuben was a very, very naughty boy, and he actually made love to one of Jacob's wives in Jacob's absence, and so he was disinherited, and he lost his place. He lost his place to Joseph, who was the firstborn son of Rachel, the other wife of Jacob. Okay? And so Reuben has always had a chip on his shoulder. It's just in the DNA of Reuben, you know. He's always had this beef against Ephraim, against Manasseh. He's always had trouble with the sons of Joseph. And so
I think he still wants his birthright back.
Yeah, it's just sheer envy, really. He lost his place. He deserved to lose it, but he lost his place, and it went to the British, it went to the Americans, it went to the Anglo-Saxon English-speaking peoples, and they got the birthright, right? So that's a problem with the French, and it's been a problem for them for the last 2,500 years, which is a bit sad, isn't it? It's in the DNA.
And, another thing I noticed about France is that when America makes a mistake, or another country that's Israelite-based makes a mistake, they're quick to point it out. And I think that's just because when you're the older brother, don't you kind of look out after the others a little bit and say, hey, yeah, that's stupid, don't do that. They don't see what's going on within themselves, right? They do make that response to America all the time. I see the French leaders make those kind of remarks to America all the time. So I think they do that because something in them tells them, well, I'm the oldest, even though I didn't get the authority, I'm the oldest. And so they kind of look out after them and say things to them.
Yeah, you had the recent spat, didn't you, between Macron and President Trump. You know, he was a nationalist, and Macron had a problem with that, what have you. And he said some unpleasant words about Mr. Trump. And it was a bit of a diplomatic incident. Just last week, I think.
Yes.
Anyway, it's not generally appreciated that the American War of Independence was, in effect, America's first civil war. The fact is that nearly one-third of the population had supported the King of England in this epic struggle. And those who sided with England were almost certainly from the tribe of Ephraim, whereas those who supported the revolution consequently were from the tribe of Manasseh, presumably.
Yes.
Thus, Isaiah's prophecy that no man shall spare his brother, and that metaphorically speaking, every man shall eat the flesh of his own arm, was fulfilled in every sense in this titanic struggle, in which Manasseh devoured Ephraim and Ephraim Manasseh. Right? They were hurting themselves. At the end of the American War of Independence, the people of America, having thrown off their colonial shackles, had become Americans. Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, there was as yet no unified American Republic. The peace treaty with England was made between the 13 colonies that had succeeded in becoming 13 independent states. The Declaration of Independence only implied a league of friendship between 13 small independent countries. It did not imply union. The reality at the time was that it was the emergency of the war that had created the necessity for the states to bind together. But once the war was over, the bond was practically dissolved, and every state did its own thing and went its own way. Had this scenario continued, America would never have walked in the destiny of her birthright, and she never would have become the great nation that Patriarch Jacob had prophesied she would become.
Absolutely. I can see that.
Yeah, got that. So once again, it was George Washington who, together with other leaders, became the catalyst for change. As he presided over the drafting of the Constitution of the United States of America, he was subsequently elected unanimously, and he's the only president who's ever had that honor to be elected unanimously as the first president of the United States. And to date, he still holds the unique record as the only unanimously elected president in the history of America.
You know, I heard about this when I was reading the history, and it was really interesting because they said they couldn't agree on anything. When the Constitutional convention came together, they couldn't agree on anything. The only thing they could agree on is that George Washington needed to lead. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, he was God's chosen vessel, wasn't he,
really? Yes, he was.
The inauguration took place significantly in New York, the new stronghold of the Hebrews, near the spot now marked by Ward's statue of him in Wall Street. And once in New York, he traveled to the city in a special barge festooned with the stars and stripes and was greeted by a joyful crowd en route. And looking back at this event, we realize what a momentous occasion it was, as George Washington took the oath of office before a cheering crowd, and he thus became the first American president under a democratic governmental system that has provided for the peaceful transition of power for more than two centuries. Now, the question is, did George Washington understand the significance of what he did subsequently? Washington took his oath of office with his hand placed on an open Bible, and it was he who started that tradition of giving the oath of office on an open Bible for the president-elect to choose the Bible passage for the occasion. So Washington inaugurated that practice. And ever since Washington's inauguration, it's been the president's prerogative to choose his own Bible passage for his oath of office, and different presidents have selected various passages. Now, Washington's selection was highly significant. The question is, did he realize how significant it was? As whilst he gave the oath, his hand rested on the King James Bible, opened at Genesis chapter 49. This is the very place in the Bible text where the patriarch Jacob blesses his 12 sons. And more significantly, this is the very place that records Jacob's prophetic and most beautiful words to his son Joseph, the inheritor of the birthright.
Do you not believe that these people that were founders of this country did not understand the 12 tribes of Israel and where they were? I believe they understood it.
Yeah, I think that must be the case, you know. I'm going to go now to Genesis 49, and I'm going to read you the exact words. You know the words, of course, Linda, but, you know, just for the sake of your listeners. It says in verse 22 of Genesis 49, it says, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. That indicates that Joseph is not a stay-at-home kind of a fella. His branches run over the wall, right? And one of his branches that ran over the wall, which is England, was the United States of America.
Yes, that's true.
The British have created about 60 nations around the world, 60, 65 nations around the world. United States of America was one of them. At the time, it was 13 colonies, but it became one. So the branches run over the wall. And then in verse 25 and 26, it says the following, by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you, with the blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors, this is Jacob speaking, and up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. And what you find about America, she is separate from the other nations. No question. She's surrounded by oceans. It's also true of Great Britain, separate from the other nations. Also true of Canada, separate from the other nations. Also true of Australia, separate from the other nations. Also true of New Zealand, separate from the other nations. Also true of South Africa. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So this is Joseph's inheritance, given the richest land and the most favorable climate. And in everything Joseph did, God prospered in his hands. And it's been very much the story of the Anglo-Saxon peoples, the English-speaking peoples around the world. So this raises the question of whether George Washington understood the enormous significance of those words as he took his oath of office on that auspicious day, on April the 30th, 1789. One cannot but wonder whether Washington realized that he was God's appointed instrument in bringing those prophetic words into reality. As the great man is not with us anymore to give us the answer, we can only surmise that what was in his heart at the time. Nevertheless, it's fascinating to think that Washington consciously chose this particular passage of the Bible because he understood that America was descended from Joseph, the chosen birthright son of Israel.
No doubt. According,
yeah, I think so. But, you know, we can't be absolute about it, but I do think so. I think it points that in that direction, definitely. According to some accounts, Washington kissed his very Bible passage at the end of his oath of office as the first president of the United States of America. It was the birth of a new nation. It was also a prophetic moment of the highest order, as the descendants of the tribe of Manasseh inherited their divinely apportioned sovereign territory in the new world. It was the preordained moment was to claim his share of the birthright covenant God had made with Abraham and reiterated with Isaac and reiterated again with Jacob. The birth process itself had been exceedingly painful as the nation was born in the crucible of fratricidal war. And when the two brothers Ephraim and Manasseh fought each other almost to a standstill, and after the victory, that untamed spirit of freedom has forever imbued America, as she has ever since become known as the land of liberty and the land of the free.
Which kind of represents Jubilee, doesn't it?
Jubilee, yes. And it's interesting that America has 50 states. When you look at the presidential seal, the 50 states surround the presidential seal. That's a picture of the Jubilee. So now we have the Civil War coming up next. Ephraim defies Manasseh, the Civil War. In the American Civil War, we have yet another occasion when the Isaiah prophecy seems to come to its partial fulfillment. We need to bear in mind that it was the Englishmen descended from the tribe of Ephraim who first established their colonial settlements in America. And this means that at that point in history, large segments of America's white population, perhaps as much as a third, were from the tribe of Ephraim. The American Civil War may well be seen as Manasseh, the older son of Joseph, asserting himself over Ephraim, his younger brother. We've already seen that the War of Independence, nearly a third of the colonial population took up arms on the side of the King of England. Most of those would have been of English descent, meaning that they had descended from Ephraim, the younger son of Joseph. It appears also that in the south of the USA, the dominant element was composed of the tribe of Ephraim. In the southern states, the aristocratic landowners of mainly English stock operated the feudal system of England. They managed huge plantations spread over vast territories, requiring the work of thousands of slaves. And the chief crops grown in these plantations was cotton, to fulfill the almost insatiable demand from the great cotton mills of England. And it's a well-documented fact, the British favored the South in the Civil War.
Yeah, that's true.
In the Revolutionary War of the American Independence, when Ephraim in the South started a rebellion against the Union. From this, we can see that Isaiah's prophecy may well have been fulfilled more than once. And it's uncanny how well the prophecy describes what happened during the American Civil War. As Manasseh devoured Ephraim and Ephraim devoured Manasseh, these two brothers and sons of Joseph truly were devouring the flesh of their own arm. They were inflicting the most ghastly self-harm upon their nation with an unspeakable ferocity that cost the lives of 620,000 soldiers.
Wow.
An undetermined number of civilians. And this has proved by far the bloodiest conflict in all of American history, in which 10% of all Northern males from age 20 to 45 years of age died, as did 30% of all Southern white males from age 18 to 45. Ghastly numbers. A fascinating point is that the symbols associated with the very first battle in the conflict pointed directly to Manasseh and Ephraim. And this is extraordinary. It can't be just a coincidence. The first battle of the American Civil War took place at Manassas in Virginia.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. in Manassas, Virginia. Furthermore, I'm not finished yet. There's more to come. Furthermore, the Northern forces, the Yankees, refer to this first battle as Bull Run. Now, Bull Run was named after a creek that was in the vicinity of the town of Manassas. And the paramount symbol of Ephraim is the bull. And the English characteristically refer to themselves as John Bull.
That's true.
The bull is the symbol of Ephraim. The Southern Confederate States forces, on the other hand, called the battle Manassas, after the nearby town. When you place these statements side by side, we see a subliminal acknowledgement to the battle by the two brother tribes of Israel, by both the North and the South. The North was fighting Ephraim the bull, whereas the South was fighting Manasseh at a place called Manassas. As a point of interest, even the nickname Yankee is derived from a Hebrew form of Jacob. It was at that first battle at Manassas, Bull Run, that General Beauregard decided to change the Confederate flag to avoid confusion on the battlefield between the Union and the Confederate forces. And the Confederate flag was given a red background with two crossed blue stripes containing the number 13. Again, beautiful symbolism in that Confederate flag. There'd been a big controversy about it last year, I think. Very unnecessary, I feel. But, you know, you remember that Jacob crossed his arms,
right,
to bless Ephraim and give Ephraim the primary birthright. Well, the South is mainly Ephraim. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
The South was composed mainly of Ephraim, and they rebelled against Manasseh in the North. They chose the crossed arms of Jacob as the predominant symbol of their flag.
Yeah? Yes.
And then they have 13 stars, which you find in all of American heraldry. You find the number 13 about 120 times in American heraldry. It's just amazing.
It's amazing.
And, of course, most people are not aware of what it means, but the meaning is quite extraordinary. Now, I'll tell you if you like, but you know already, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And that's that's why Satan calls it an unlucky number.
Yes,
they don't want to make that connection.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm not going to tell you what it means, and you don't tell anybody either. And let any listener who wants to know what it means, well, you contact Linda or you phone in or something, and you'll find out. Or perhaps more to the point, why didn't you get my book, Who Are You, America? You can get it on Amazon. It's a book called Who Are You, America? I wrote it. It's in my name, Stephen J. Spikerman, and you can get it on Amazon, Who Are You, America? It's a brilliant book that explains everything about America's heraldry, America's history, the whole background, the whole nine yards, all of it. Beautifully illustrated. It's going to be a real asset if you can get that book.
Yes, I will tell you, everyone that's listening, you ought to have a copy of that book because it goes into all that heraldry, especially that I like, Stephen. If you haven't gotten that book, by all means, try and get a hold of that book.
The American Civil War be referred to as a war of rebellion, as in effect the Southern states rebelled against the North and the Union. And in this respect, we see yet another parallel with ancient Israel. When the great split occurred in ancient Israel, it was the tribe of Ephraim which led the rebellion, resulting in the breakaway of the 10 tribes of Israel to set up their own independent kingdom to the north of Judah. What we witness in the Civil War is a kind of replay. Here again we see the tribe of Ephraim leading the secessionist rebellion of the Confederate States of America. In the first rebellion in ancient Israel, it was the tribes of the North who were led by Ephraim that seceded from the South, that is Judah. In the second rebellion, the American one, in the Civil War, the reverse was the case, as the tribes of the South, once again led by Ephraim, seceded from the North. So there are all these amazing biblical parallels with what happened in ancient Israel. And of course, there are so many of them, it can't be an accident. In the Civil War, American Civil War, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederation, led the South. And the meaning of the name Davis is son of David. And thus, by his very name, we see here a reference to King David of Israel.
Wow. In a way, that's actually kind of showing the split between 10 tribes and Judah, right? I mean, that's kind of the symbol for that also.
Yeah. It doesn't end there either, because at the same time, a man of Jewish birth named Judah Philip Benjamin was the Secretary of State for the Confederate States of America.
Oh, my goodness. Stephen, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, there you are. There's a high degree of irony in this, as in the first division in ancient Israel, the northern tribes, led by Ephraim, split away from Judah and Benjamin, right? Judah and Benjamin, under the house of David. In the second division, i.e. in the Civil War, Ephraim under Davis, with Judah, Philip, Benjamin, attempted to split away, but they were prevented from doing so by Abraham Lincoln, a man named Abraham, the first patriarch of Israel. Can we not see the hand of God in this amazing irony?
Yeah, the same names go over and over again.
Okay. Thus, the several thousand years prior to the actual events, the prophet Isaiah had prophesied in a most descriptive way exactly what was destined to happen to these two sons of Joseph. He prophesied that Manasseh would devour Ephraim and that Ephraim would devour Manasseh, not only in the War of Independence, but also during the subsequent civil war. And thus these two brothers and sons of Joseph truly were devouring the flesh of their own arm. As with brother killing brother, they were inflicting excruciating self-harm upon their nation, not once, but twice in their history. Sadly, prior to the Civil War, between June 1812 and February 1815, there had been yet another occasion when those two sons of Joseph found themselves at war, this time over Canadian territory. The United States, confident in their victory over England, declared war on England on June 18, 1812, whilst the English were still heavily involved in their war against Napoleon and Napoleon's France. And the English had their hands full with Napoleon.
Yes, they did, because Napoleon was one to not be messed with.
No. The U.S. troops entered Canada unopposed on July the 12th. A bit of a dirty trick, really, some might say.
Yes.
But, you know, it looked like easy picking. So, you know, human nature being what it is, Canada seemed to be easy pickings for the United States. Why not have a go and extend our territory? So the U.S. troops entered Canada unopposed on July the 12th, only to be subsequently forced to retreat to Detroit. So they didn't have a lot of territory to gain, where they suffered defeat at the hands of the British. Much of the fighting on land thereafter takes place around the Canadian lakes, with the battle of the next 2.5 years ebbing to and fro, with respectively 8 victories to the British and 6 to the American forces. Yet the United States Army suffered one of their worst humiliations ever.
Yes.
When after the Battle of Bladensburg, the British were able to march into Washington, D.C., the President and Mrs. Madison, who were about to stage a state dinner, had only just a few hours to quickly pack a few things and rush out the presidential mansion or face capture by General Ross, the British commander. The troops under his command, first of all, enjoyed all the wines and all the delicious food of the state dinner. And then when they were well sated and well fed, they burnt the White House down to the ground. They also burnt the Capitol building, plus many other buildings in the city of Washington, D.C. On the lakes and on the seas, however, the Yankee captain, able to greatly humble His Majesty's invincible Royal Navy. And this was especially the case in the battle on Lake Champlain, where the Americans were able to defeat the superior British fleet by giving the Brits a terrible pasting. American privateers and buccaneers, in the meantime, relentlessly pursued the merchant convoys of the British Empire on the seven seas at a huge cost to the King's treasury. And then finally, on February the 17th, 1815, President Madison officially declared an end to the War of 1812. Clearly, therefore, Isaiah's prophecy about these two brother tribes was actually fulfilled not twice, but 3 times. Thus, this one prophetic utterance written down and recorded in the book of Isaiah provides us with evidence that America and Great Britain and her Commonwealth daughters are descended from Manasseh and Ephraim, the birthright sons of Joseph. Isaiah's prophecy thus adds to the realms of additional evidence that America and Great Britain are Israelite nations, Hebrew nations, as only in American and British history this prophecy finds its most perfect fulfillment, not once, not twice, but three times.
Right. There we are. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on with us, and this was a wonderful message, a blessing to all. Good night.